shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians, called to a higher level of understanding, will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Tonight, I want to talk to you about something that we should know, and so very few people do. We've taken for the subject tonight, the price of liberty. You know, of course, the old saying, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And for lazy people, and for cowardly people, it is a price higher than they've been willing to pay. And the result is that no nation has enjoyed liberty any great length of time. Liberty is prized enough that they're willing to pay the price of it by those who have fought their way out from under tyranny. It's prized to a certain extent by their children, very moderately by their grandchildren, and from that time on you begin the gradual descent back into tyranny. You know, the number of people in this world who have been misruled by conquering foreign tyrants is not nearly as great as the number of people who have been misruled by tyrannical governments of their own making. Upon that basis, our own nation was founded. Our Constitution is the best devised instrument that man has ever worked under of all those systems that were worked out by man. There was only one better system, and that was the one worked out by our God in the Bible. And you remember, there was only one generation on the part of another that they very seriously tried to follow it. Was, unfortunately, a little too good for ordinary men to be able to maintain. Our Constitution is based upon the idea of not letting any politician begin to think himself too powerful. We don't want any masters, any leaders, and our Constitution is not intended to have any. The executive is designed under the Constitution to be exactly that and nothing more, to execute, to carry into effect the policies which are worked out by the legislative branch of the government, which is the one which establishes all policies. And it is merely the job of the executive to see that they are carried out. And when one man says, I should dominate, and the nation should be run according to my will, he not only is asking for himself powers that are unconstitutional, but powers also that mean the destruction of our liberty if we let him get away with it long. The only alternative is to have in Congress men strong enough that they will not submit to domination by the executive, that they'll just whittle him down to life size whenever there comes a clash on policy, that they will balk when he says this is must legislation, that if he vetoes things which the Congress feels the public wants, they will pass it over his veto and reduce him from master to the public servant, which is what he is meant to be. Now we're told, oh, but now you mustn't have these conflicts of opinion. We must have confidence in the leaders we have selected. We must have confidence in their good intentions. We must have confidence in their wisdom, our own politicians and those in the United Nations. One of the least appreciated, but perhaps the greatest man this country ever produced, the greatest thinker, even if not so much the man of action that captures the public eye, was Thomas Jefferson. And it was Thomas Jefferson who said, confidence is the debt of liberty. And he's right. When you stop keeping your politicians under a watchful and, say it frankly, a suspicious eye, your liberties begin going down the drain. If the man you have elected to office is not getting egotistical over it, then your watchfulness of him is certainly not going to hurt him, and it shouldn't hurt his feelings, because it ought to go with the job. And if he is planning taking into his hands power that he should not have, then certainly your watchfulness is desperately needed. Oh, we've had confidence with the same disastrous results that Thomas Jefferson said. We trusted our leaders, and what was the consequence of it? The consequence was the death of hundreds of thousands of our sons in World War I, World War II, and World War III that we're already in, and the impoverishment of our nation until our great-grandchildren will be impoverished by it. Our whole world system has not been destroyed by that time. That's the consequences of confidence. It's time we kept an eye on things. And to keep an eye on things, you have to know what to look for. And to determine that, therefore, it's time we took a look at the past and see what it is that has led up to this situation. What brought about just the condition that we have here? I don't need to tell you, of course, of Karl Marx, his Das Kapital, and the original Communist Manifesto of, what was it, 1848? I don't need to remind you of how that started, nor where it was leading, nor the fact that Marx and his two chief collaborators, Friedrich and Engels, were all Jews, and that they sought, Marx quite openly, the destruction of Christianity. It was not so much that he opposed religion in general. He didn't oppose Judaism at all, because Karl Marx was the grandson of a rabbi on both sides of the family. But he taught quite expressly that Christianity was the chief enemy that stood in their path and must be suppressed and destroyed. Now, the next important step to watch for, as we look back over this, was the First World Zionist Congress, held in the city of Basel, Switzerland, in 1897, where the World Zionist Organization was created. This is also the time of the writing of the famous Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. Now, it is entirely possible that the protocols are not a stenographic record of the larger meetings of this assembly. It may very well be that there were some who attended that, who could not be trusted with as frank a discussion as takes place in the protocols. But wherever the meeting was held, and however many were admitted to the meeting where those lectures were given, it was at about that time that those took place. You know, of course, the history of the protocols. One of the delegates from Petrograd, or as they called it then, Petersburg, took stenographic notes of the lectures at those meetings, them in shorthand. And when he got back to Petrograd, he lost his notebook on the street. It was found by someone who could not read shorthand. All he knew was, here was a notebook full of some odd chicken tracks that weren't any writing he knew about. But he did know Professor Nihlus of the University of Petrograd, and he went to him. And he said, Professor, I found a notebook with some queer foreign writing in it. I wonder if you can read it. And Nihlus looked at it, and he could read Russian shorthand, and that's what it was. So he said, yes, I can read this. Leave it with me. Maybe I can find the owner's name and address in it and return it to him. So it was left with him. And he read it, and what he read astounded him so, he transcribed it all and had it published in Russian, of course. That was published sometime around 1900. The copy in the British Museum has their receipt stamp on its cover showing a 1905 date when it was received there. I don't need to go over that again and point out to you how everything that has taken place since then, and the steps leading toward world revolution and the destruction of civilization, has followed exactly the course laid out for it in the protocols, and the people who have done all this work have been exactly the same people who were speaking in the Protocols. Possession of a copy of that book, The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, is punished by death. Any place that communism, which is to say the Jews, come into power. That's how much they dread having people know what is in that book, because it can't be explained away. The silly charge of forgery doesn't mean a thing. If they didn't write it, and there's no reason to believe they didn't, they certainly have adopted it word for word, and nobody else is trying to carry it into effect. Now, following that meeting, the first steps toward putting it into effect came in Russia. Remember, the men who had planned this thing had looked ahead. They knew that their power in the nations of white portion of the world, their power there was financial. It enabled them to rule only indirectly through corruption and intimidation of the politicians. But that didn't satisfy them. Their arrogance would be satisfied with nothing less than swaggering around, kicking everybody else out of their way. And to do that, they had to have tremendous manpower. You remember what they say in the Protocols? If any nation will not accept our power, we will destroy it with the guns of the United States or of China. Now, they've been carrying that out. They were looking for tremendous manpower in Asia and tremendous manufacturing power and ingenuity here in the United States. Now, the key to Asia, of course, was Russia. They couldn't take over China without first taking over Russia. And they were strong in Russia. Remember that a great portion of the Khazar Jews lived in Russia. So, especially in the years leading up to 1905, you had intense revolutionary activity in Russia. Now, of course, we were deluged with propaganda about the great cruelty of life under the Tsars. There is no question that there was less liberty in all parts of Asia, including Russia, than we have known here at home. It's also true that there was less liberty in all other parts of the world, including all of Europe and England. But the point is that these peoples had never had anything else. They had a type of government which was their own type, which they had maintained for thousands of years. They had never sought, they had never maintained a government of any other type. It took a rigid authoritarian government to rule backward barbarians and semi-barbarians. And except for a tiny little educated crust on top, by and large, the Russians were Asiatic barbarians. Many of them nomads living in their tents as they followed the seasons north and then south. Now there you began seeing the Jewish revolutionary activity carried on in the customary way by the assassination of public officers, by attempts at armed uprising, by the attempts to set up Jewish states. For example, at one time in 1905, they had seized power in the Ukraine to such an extent that the paper money of the Ukraine was printed in Yiddish, not Russian, Yiddish. They had set up a Jewish government over the Ukraine. That was put down, and murderous revolutionaries have to be treated with force. You can't go out and throw marshmallows at them from 80 paces and put a stop to a revolution that way. It isn't done. Those who seize power by blood can only be stopped by force. And it was stopped the only way it could be, by a show of greater force than they had. So then you began having the great flood of Jew revolutionists to this country with their tales of terrible persecution in Russia and their stories of phony pogroms that never happened. Now the next step that was brought about, and still in line with Karl Marx's teachings and with the Protocols, with World War I, their program for getting the Christian nations of the world to destroy each other. That served two purposes. three purposes. One was to get the Christian nations of the world to reduce each other to ruin. Second, to enrich the Jews while impoverishing all the whites, Christians. And third, to break Russia's power to the point where the Jews could take over and take control of it. It was carefully engineered for those three purposes. It's history now. It's come out in great part. You know the story of how, after England had been engineered into that war and found that it was a tough thing, the Jew chemist, Chaim Weizmann, inventor of a new and more reliable method for making TNT. See, TNT was a very valuable war explosive, even in World War II. But it was something that was very ticklish in the making. Many a manufacturing plant was blowing up trying to make TNT by the old processes, which were highly uncertain and dangerous. And Weizmann discovered a new and more reliable way to make TNT. So he went to England, armed with the patents on this thing, and he said, "Now, here's what I'm going to do. I will put this at your disposal if and only if I get your commitment that you will take Palestine away from its present owners and turn it over to the Jews." England wasn't willing to go that far at that time. You remember the Balfour Declaration was worded much more conservatively than that. It says that the English government views with favor the establishment of a national home for the Jews in Palestine, but with due regard to all the rights, civil, political, and religious, of the non-Jewish population in Palestine. That was worked out with Balfour and Lloyd George. Then, and this has come out in Lloyd George's memoirs, there was the further agreement made that if the British would support this scheme of conquest of Palestine for the Jews in turn would use all their efforts to bring the United States into the war on the side of England. You know, of course, how that was done. You remember one of the Englishmen wrote a book after the war. The man who himself had personally written much of the phony propaganda about non-existent supposed acts of brutality and terror on the part of the German army, he wrote a book after posting how he had made up these falsehoods out of thin air and circulated them, because, of course, there was no way for any news to get to this country except over cables which led either from France or from England, and they had a complete censorship of news, and no denial could reach us. He boasted how these things were circulated in this country and were a very big factor in arousing public opinion to the point where it would support the United States' entrance into the war. You remember how Woodrow Wilson pulled the same stunt that Franklin D. Roosevelt did. He sought re-election upon a program that he had kept us out of war and would keep us out of war, at the same time that he was insincerely plotting to get us into the war. And very promptly after his re-election to the war, he was elected in the peace platform in 1916, you'll recall. The elections in November 1916 and by April 1917, in violation of his pledges, he had put us into war. Now it's interesting to note some of the things that were done in that war. There is a good deal of evidence. It's not conclusive. You can't say it is proved to a mathematical certainty, but there is a good deal of evidence in support of the statement that Woodrow Wilson himself was a Marano. A Marano, you know, is a Jew who pretends to be a Christian, but who has not given up his Jewish religion. In any event, in that way, he eased us in. Now let's look a little at the background. The Warburg family, you know, were very important Jewish bankers in Europe and became so here. Paul Moritz Warburg, leaving the big M.M. Warburg banking company headquarters in Hamburg, Germany, came to the United States in 1902 and became associated with the Jew banking firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company. Now, he came in as an alien. He was not naturalized as an American citizen until 1911. But in 1910, while still an alien, he drew up the Federal Reserve Banking System, which was enacted into law in 1913, and of which Woodrow Wilson boasted so much that was one of the great accomplishments of his administration, to give the Jewish bankers a complete stranglehold upon our money system. Now, this Warburg family is interesting to follow in the war that soon came on. Here in the United States, one of the brothers, Paul Warburg, through the M.M. Warburg Company, Jewish bankers, was financing the American side of the war. He was in the U.S. Treasury Department as head of the Liberty Bond business, and the M.M. Warburg Company was the chief agent in financing the American side of the war. At the same time, Brother Max Warburg, over in Hamburg, Germany, through the Jewish banking firm of M.M. Warburg Company, was financing the German side of the war. Same firm enriching itself out of both sides, getting two Christian nations to destroy each other as far as they could. Winston Churchill, in the days before the Jews owned him body and soul, when he published his earlier works on World War I, spoke quite angrily of the American entry into World War I. He said, if you had kept out of it, World War I would have been settled 2 years earlier and without the devastation of Europe. And of course it would have. The tremendous devastation came, not in the original fighting by which portions of France were occupied by the German army, but in the terrific fighting that it took to oust them. They were about ready to settle that thing by negotiation, get the Germans out of France, everybody back in their own territory. And when it appeared that the war was likely to end as a draw with nobody victor, then the United States was eased into it. The purpose of that war was, as I say, to as far as possible have the Christian nations destroy each other, and secondly, to break down the great barrier to the westward movement of Asia into Europe. There were two strong nations which stood as a solid wall against any invasion of Europe by Asia. Those nations were Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. As the result of that war, the Hungarian Empire was indeed, Austro-Hungarian Empire was indeed destroyed. It was broken up into a lot of little nations, and with all the talk about self-determination for smaller peoples, that wasn't followed out consistently at all. You had, for example, Yugoslavia, where the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, three peoples who hated each other bitterly, were combined into one nation and left to see which group could tyrannize over the other to everybody's intense trouble. You have similar troubles of minority groups put where they didn't belong elsewhere. You remember that when Czechoslovakia was created, Masaryk, their great patriot, protested bitterly against the Sudeten Mountain area being included in Czechoslovakia. He said there are very few Czechs in that area. Its population is almost exclusively German. They are not going to be contented to be ruled by another nation. It's going to be a troublesome problem, and eventually it's going to involve us in war with Germany seeking to get it back. He was overruled on the ground that this served two purposes. First, it weakened Germany. Second, it gave a more militarily defensible frontier in the mountains than the borders of the area occupied by the Czechs would furnish. Even Lloyd George himself, and he was a man who had fought the war hard, Lloyd George was bitter and disillusioned about the outcome because he saw that it had merely laid the seeds, sowed the seeds of another war. Whatever injustices may have occurred to begin with, new injustices were piled on top of them by the treaty. Situations created which could only result in such irritation that they would eventually provoke war again. In spite of what some propagandists like to say, wars come when nations find that the troubles of peace are becoming more intolerable than the troubles of war to get rid of them. Another interesting thing that showed how World War I was run was in the great Snyder Crusoe plant. They were the inventors and makers of the famous French 75 artillery. They had a very extensive manufacturing empire, partly in France, partly in Germany. It's interesting to note that when the war broke out, and of course no trading back and forth across the frontier was permissible, and sending money back and forth would be trading with the enemy, the French and the German divisions of the firm went at it the same way. The French firm could not pay dividends to the German shareholders, so they put it in a trust fund to be held for them until after the war. The German division of the firm could not pay dividends to the French shareholders, so they created a trust fund and held them until after the war. The Snyder Crusoe plant was, of course, Jewish-owned. So, again, like the Warburg banking family, they were working for both sides at tremendous profit, helping the Christians to slaughter each other. In 1918, this World Zionist organization, created, you remember, in 1897, in 1918 they held a meeting in Copenhagen and issued the famous Copenhagen Manifesto. They demanded that Palestine be turned over to the Jews, and they made another curious demand, that the Jews in all countries of the world should have complete autonomy, that they should be regarded as a separate nation within a nation, ruling themselves and not governed by the laws of the nation. Here's the way they phrased it, and I quote, "National autonomy," that's self-rule, complete, "national autonomy with regard to cultural, social, and political activities for the Jewish communities of all countries with a Jewish mass population and of all other countries where the Jewish population may demand such autonomy." And the Jews sent a delegation to the meeting at Versailles, where the Treaty of Versailles was drawn up, muscled in, acting as though they were one of the nations present, to put up their demands. And strangely enough, those demands were listened to and largely embodied into the treaty. By the Versailles Treaty, all the loser nations were compelled to give favored treatment to the Jews above that given to their own citizens. No elections or other important matters could be held on Saturday because that would interfere with the Jews' Sabbath. No restriction about holding anything on a day that might interfere with the Christian Sunday, however. The Jews were required to be paid a proportionate share of the public education money for the maintenance of their own private Jewish schools. Now, you know what a big yell goes up in this country when the Catholics say, "We maintain our own schools here and relieve the general public of that much expense of educating that many of the children, and will you let the school buses pick up our children and carry them to and from our schools?" A tremendous hue and cry is raised, but that is subsidizing one sect at the expense of the general public, and a wrongful thing to do, and I'm inclined to agree with it. But if that be wrong as to a Christian, why should the taxpayers be required to furnish a portion of the public education money to the Jews to maintain their own private schools, and yet that was written into the Treaty of Versailles for the loser nations. Another interesting thing which followed this, of course, you had the organization of the League of Nations. This was flooded with Jews, as the United Nations has been, but not on so great a scale. Now the outcome of this, Russia was in Jewish hands. Communist politically, but Jewish racially. They now had their instrument to work for world power. The two great Christian nations which barred their progress west were broken. The Austro-Hungarian nation permanently, and it was thought that Germany also had been destroyed to where she could never rise. Now, not only did the British blockade of Germany cause, probably more than anything else, the defeat of Germany in World War I, because it prevented her from getting necessary raw materials, oil and so forth. But you remember, perhaps, that that blockade was continued for more than a year after the war ended to reduce the German people to practical starvation. It brought German industries to a standstill. Now remember that most of the nations of the world are not as fortunate as the United States. We could get along very well under a total blockade where nothing could get in. Sure, we'd have to give up bananas and coffee and chocolate. And we'd have to use certain alloys of steel that are perhaps not quite as good as certain others, or else develop our own deposits of those alloy metals, which are here, if we use them. But most of the other nations are not in that lucky position. England, if England didn't have foreign trade, she'd soon be reduced to starvation because she has to import most of the food she eats. Japan was the same way. Germany was the same way. Germany did not produce within her own borders all the food her people wanted to eat. It couldn't produce the wool and the cotton to clothe her people. It couldn't produce many of the things that are needed in modern civilization. And therefore, the only way that nations like that can live is by foreign trade. They produce some things that other nations want. They sell those, and with the money thus obtained, they buy from the other nations what they need. All during the war and for more than a year afterward, Germany was under total blockade. So now, remember, you're putting yourself for the moment in the position of this German factory owner. Your plant has been shut down because you've had no materials on which to run it. You still can't get them. All your savings with which you could hope to buy anything are in government bonds that they've been compelled to repudiate. And if you've got money from anywhere to get anything from outside, the blockade is still on. And then because of the terrific unpayable debt of so-called reparations, which exceeded many times the actual damage done, terrific taxes have been laid on you. So, since you can't run your plant to make any income, you're about to lose it to the tax collector. Along comes a Jew and he says, "Oi, nice plant you have here. Worth 28 million marks, isn't it? And you're going to lose it next month. I give you 500 marks for it." Robbery, isn't it? But you remember that you don't have anything to buy food for your children at home with, because you haven't had any income for this more than a year. All your savings tied up. And you say, "I'm going to lose the plant anyway." Well, 500 marks, better than nothing. "Ah, nice home you got, worth 85,000 marks. I give you 200 for it." That was done. That was done tens of thousands of times by these wretched scoundrels who don't know how to be honest. And do you wonder that there was dissatisfaction in the hearts of the German people? What was there left in Germany that those parasites who hadn't done any of it didn't know? They were a thrifty, industrious people. They began trying to build back their own civilization. They began trying to become once again the masters of their own houses. And all along now, there had been this tremendous flood of Jew propaganda kept up unceasingly. It didn't stop after the war was won. You know, in every previous war we've ever had, Once we licked our enemy, we were ready to hold out the hand of peace and say, now, it's all over, let's live in peace. But you remember, that was never allowed to happen after World War I. Always the continuous propaganda, destroy Germany. Open up the highway for the hordes of Asia to march west into Europe. They didn't tell you that part, but destroy Germany. Germany began regaining its strength. France began, rather hysterically, to demand the destruction of Germany. Now, you've gotten a lot of propaganda about how terribly France has been invaded by Germany. You know, I remember when I was in high school, I was on a debating team that debated on that at the time when we were still neutral. And to debate it, I had to look up some history. And I was getting ready to make a tremendous argument. Look how these terrible Germans have so repeatedly marched west across the Rhine to invade France. So I looked up the history. And I found that France had marched eastward into Germany almost twice as many times as Germany had marched west into France. So I reluctantly laid aside an argument that proved not so good after all. The Germans were beginning to gain back a little of their own nation. You had some German manufacturing plants that were not Jew-owned now. Not all German trade was Jew trade. And they were trying to give their own plants a chance. You have the beginnings already now of the Jew work against them through the League of Nations. Then England got into her old role. Now you know, of course, that I believe the British are indeed our blood brothers, that they are one half of the descendants of Joseph, and we're basically the other half, although we have, of course, all the tribes of Israel here in this country. And I have for them a great respect and desire to see them prosper. But for some of the people who govern them, I do not have that respect because I know what their policies lead to. Now, they thrived for a long time on their balance of power strategy. They kept Europe divided into two armed camps and frequently at war. And first they would help Part A defeat Part B. Then they would immediately make an alliance with Part B and help it defeat Part A. So that each one kept the other in hot water and too weakened to do much. So the British began playing their old balance of power game. They wanted Europe to be ruled entirely according to their ideas, and France had some contrary ideas. I'm not undertaking to pass upon the merits of who had the better idea. I haven't studied it enough to find out. But the fact is that there was a clash there. And so the British began supporting Germany, not with the idea that they wanted Germany to get back to be an important nation, but as a club over the head of France, to make France fall into line with British policy. And it's exactly what they're starting to do now when they're undertaking to play off Russia against the United States. Balance of power is a nice diplomatic phrase for it, and blackmail is the other word. So now you had a nation which was trying to get back on its feet. Remember now, a nation which can only live by foreign trade. Germany and England just alike in that. Rivals for foreign trade. So on the one hand, the British government, playing its balance of power plan, was promoting the rise of Germany to power. And on the other hand, the partly Jewish-owned and for the rest Jewish-financed British industry was saying, these people are competitors of ours in foreign trade. Do all we can to shut them out. Now, by that time, the conflict within Germany between the German people and the Jews, who was going to run their nation, was becoming very acute. You know what the Jews are doing here in this country to run it. And they were facing the same sort of situation there. They began trying to throw it off. They began to say, by blackmail extortion, our factories, our homes, our lands were taken from us by these Jews after World War I. We want them back. So now, first through the League of Nations and then generally afterward, you began to see the great worldwide Jewish boycott of all German goods. Not only are the Jews the principal merchants in most nations, so that just they alone, by their boycott, could largely prevent foreign trade, but also nobody else dared buy German goods. You know the means of pressure the Jews have put on any merchant who would deal in German goods. And what happens to him when he goes to the Jewish-controlled bank for a loan? The second preparatory World Jewish Conference, held in Geneva, September 8, 1933, organized the worldwide boycott of Germany. That was September. In October, the Jewish Communist Third International also came out for a worldwide boycott of all German goods. Now, trade is of necessity a two-way street. A nation which needs to buy cannot long buy unless it can also sell an equal amount with which to get money to continue buying. And by boycotting the sale of all German goods, they were effectively stopping the importation of any outside goods into Germany. Then, in August 1936, at Geneva, the first World Jewish Congress was held. In the opening address by Dr. Stephen S. Wise, the chief rabbi of the United States, he declared that no Jew would be excluded from this movement by reason of his political and economic views. In other words, they were ready to cooperate fully with the communists. One of the interesting things brought out at that meeting in the address of Dr. Nathan Goldman, rabbi, is this statement. The march to the great international court of justice cannot be accomplished in just a few years. In order to bring it to a positive conclusion, there is need for one thing, to outgrow the concept of the sovereign state. Rather strange that these people who say they've got to destroy your sovereignty over yourself, at the same time say that they must be recognized as a separate sovereign state within your borders. Internationalism for you, nationalism for them. In 1937, you had the great Madison Square Garden organization meeting of the American Jewish Congress and the Jewish Labor Committee meeting. A great mass demonstration. They had hired a great many molders of public opinion. Among them, General Hugh Johnson, Fiorello LaGuardia, John L. Lewis, Rabbi Stephen Wise, to get the propaganda going for the Second World War. In 1938, you remember, a German diplomat in Paris was murdered by a Jew, and German patience was wearing thin. Revolutionary Jews were being expelled from Germany. They were being told, if you can't be good citizens of the land in which you live, we'll liquidate your holdings and get out. And I think that's what we should tell them here. The intensified Jewish boycott had reached the strangulation point for Germany. Her national existence was threatened. In 1939, Hitler declared that the Jews were threatening world peace by the situation they were bringing about. Whatever you may say against Hitler, that statement of his was true because they were fomenting world war. Poland, Hungary, and Romania were trying to control Jewish revolutionary organizations in spite of the shackles of the Versailles Treaty, requiring them to grant political autonomy to the Jews. And they finally had to announce that, like Germany, they repudiated that treaty. There were furious Jew attacks on all these nations in the League of Nations. So finally, at a point where there was no alternative but starvation, Germany began her march eastward to get control of enough land to raise food and mineral lands from which they could get the metals they needed for their own existence. So you had World War II forced by the Jewish boycott that left no other possibility, no possibility of peaceful trade with the world. Now, from the beginning, Roosevelt was trying to get us into World War II in violation of all the accepted customs and international laws.
to inject us into that war. Not only did we turn over to the British warships, bombing planes, and so on, now you may sometimes say you're morally justified in getting in on that. And sometimes that's true. But the point is to look it in the eye and see exactly what you were doing. Public opinion in the United States would not support the United States getting into one of Europe's customary wars. Roosevelt went farther. He ordered the American Navy to convoy shipments of munitions to England and to fire upon any German submarine that came into the western half of the Atlantic, which was a direct act of war. And we did depth bomb many a German submarine. But Germany didn't reply. They'd been licked once by our getting into a war and turning the scales against them, and they weren't going to risk that again. So Roosevelt had to find some way to get us into that war. You find a very good condensation of Admiral Theobald's book. And Admiral Theobald really lifts the lid off Pearl Harbor and shows how, in order to get us into the war, Franklin Roosevelt deliberately betrayed to their deaths over 3,000 of our men. That's not the only time he did that either. We can mention a few others. The whole story is there. How the Japs, after things had reached a state of high tension between them and the United States, and I think the Japs were getting a bit too chesty, but after it reached a state of high tension, they were given a note so completely insulting, so completely outside of diplomatic usages, that actually, for a proud nation, there really could be only one answer to it, and that was war. It was simply, practically, a demand for unconditional surrender. Now, in the meantime, for months, we had been reading all the Japanese code messages, because we had broken all their code systems. And they are given here in detail. This book is not the author's opinion that this or that happens. He gives you the exact wording of each message, code message that the Japs were sending to their embassy, when it was sent, when it was decoded, when the American government had it and could read it in plain English. And he shows how over a period of months, the evidence became conclusive that the Japs were getting ready to reach the point of war to strike at Pearl Harbor. And there wasn't a competent, trained naval man who could mistake where they were going to strike. And then they began giving clearly enough to their ambassador in Washington the date when this was going to happen. They sent a message saying, if we're going to have any understanding on this thing with the American government, you're going to have to reach it by such and such a date, because after that, things are automatically going to happen. And what could automatically happen after that except carrying out their program of war? And finally, their code message is warning you now to burn all secret documents, to burn all codes in his possession. That's something that's never done unless war is imminent, just within the next 24 or 48 hours. Those were had and decoded, and neither the Army nor Navy commanders in Hawaii were given any information. Messages were sent to them merely saying that there exists a state of rather high tension between the governments of Japan and the United States, but never warning that war was known to be coming and that the date was known, or that it was known from the Jap messages that Pearl Harbor was where they were going to strike. Admiral Richardson warned Roosevelt repeatedly that the American fleet was too in the Pacific, had been reduced to the point where it was too weak to defend itself in the event of war with Japan. That keeping it at Pearl Harbor was merely bait for an attack. It would draw an attack it couldn't defend against, and asking them to be either reinforced with vessels from the Atlantic fleet, which were engaged in making undeclared war on Germany, or else brought back to the Pacific coast. And for pointing this out, Admiral Richardson was relieved of his command, and the unfortunate scapegoat, Admiral Kimmel, put in charge. Then after that, the fleet was still further weakened by taking several additional principal vessels away from it and sending them to the undeclared war in the Atlantic Ocean. And then Roosevelt sat back to prod the Japs into war. You know, there are some very interesting things. Secretary of War Stimson kept a diary on this thing, and some of the entries in his diary are very illuminating. First of all, let's consider a little bit earlier than that what came out of the so-called Atlantic Charter meeting. In August 14, 1941, Churchill and Roosevelt held their meeting, out of which was announced this Atlantic Charter. Winston Churchill said this in his speech to the House of Commons, January 27, 1942, right after the outbreak of war. The probability, note this now, the probability since the Atlantic Conference, at which I discussed these matters with Mr. Roosevelt, the probability that the United States, even if not herself attacked, would come into the war in the Far East and thus make final victory sure, seemed to allay some of the anxieties. This expectation has not been falsified by the events. It fortified our own decision to use our limited resources in the actual fighting fronts. So Roosevelt had given him the assurance that the United States, if we couldn't provoke an attack upon us, would then become the aggressor and make our own attack. Secretary Stimson's diary is most interesting. He tells of the cabinet meeting held November 25th, 1941, at which Roosevelt made clear his policies. And here's how he says it. The question was how we should maneuver them, the Japanese, how we should maneuver them into the position of firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves. It was a difficult proposition. So the Pacific Fleet was left there to be the bait for that Japanese attack. Now some things begin to be clear. On December 6th, the last telegram of so-called warning that was sent out to Hawaii was sent up, and by way of indicating that it was not urgent, instead of being sent as a preferred message, it was sent with a deferred preference. And here's what it said. In the first place, the original draft of the message began this: in view of the imminence of war. That's what the draft on file in Washington shows was originally drawn. Then that was stricken out, and the message as sent said this: in view of the international situation and the exposed position of our outlying Pacific islands, you may authorize the destruction by them of secret and confidential documents, either now or under later conditions if greater emergency develops. Is that a warning of imminent war? Now, that was sent December 6th. Now let's see what Mr. Roosevelt knew December 6th. At 9:30 p.m. on December 6th, that's 9:30 p.m. Washington time, which is 4:30 p.m. Hawaii time, December 6th, the day before the attack, the final Japanese message, which was a declaration of war, was decoded in English and handed to Roosevelt. He read it at that time. Here's what happened. When Lieutenant Schultz gave the message to President Roosevelt, he was in his study with Harry Hopkins. After reading the 13 parts of the message, he looked up and said, "This means war." Now, this was 4:30 p.m. December 6th by Hawaii time. That was 15 hours before the attack. Plenty of time to put them on the alert. He wanted to get Admiral Stark on the telephone, but was told the Admiral was at the theater. There was no mention of any other telephone call. Nothing was said about sending a warning to the fleet. No competent military man can draw any conclusion but one from that. There were lots of Jap spies in Hawaii. If the fleet was alerted, and if the Army defenses were alert,
And they began calling their men back from weekend leave. They began manning the anti-aircraft guns. They began getting steam up on the fleet and getting it out to sea where it could maneuver and have a chance to defend itself. The Jack spies would see this. They would know that the attack had been found out. They would send the message to the Jack fleet, and the Jack fleet would call off the attack, having lost the element of surprise. So in order to get his attack by the Japs, Mr. Roosevelt deliberately ordered the withholding of the information and let 3,300 good Americans to die unnecessarily at Pearl Harbor the following morning. It was not until 2 minutes before noon, Washington time, of December 7th, that a vaguely worded message saying, "We don't know just what's going to happen, but be on the alert," was sent. And instead of sending it by Army or Navy radio or radio telephone, which could have been done and sent like that, it was sent by commercial cable. It wasn't marked rush, it was marked deferred. 7 hours later, being 6 hours after the attack was over, it was delivered in Hawaii. Why am I going back over this ancient history? For this reason. Until you know what's going on behind the scenes, until you know whose is the hidden hand, until you know how they operate and what they're seeking to do, what can you do to defend your liberties? You know what happens with every organization that you try to get up. Always there comes the Jewish infiltration. They come into your Christian church. They come into your Knights of Pythias or your Masonic Lodge or whatever kind of a lodge you've got. And of course, you mustn't bring that up. You defend Brother Cohen. That's what Brother Cohen is there for. Not only is he a spy on whatever you're doing, but he also, by his mere presence and your politeness, prevents you from discussing anything that's going on. We know, of course, they frequently send their spy into even these meetings, so they don't choose an obvious Jew for that purpose. Here, however, is one place where his presence doesn't cramp our style a bit. I don't know how I could have stated more frankly than I did. Now, the price of liberty, we've been told, is eternal vigilance. It's more than that. You've got to know what to be vigilant about. It's not only vigilance, it's education. And it's time these things were spoken right out in meeting.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.